The SI Media Podcast is brought to you by the SeatGeek app, the smartest way to buy and sell tickets for your favorite events. Download the SeatGeek app and enter our code MEDIA for $20 off your first purchase. We're also sponsored by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy football, with more winners and more payouts than any other site. Enter promo code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, at FanDuel.com to enter a risk-free tournament for up to $10.
I learned that, and I mean, not just with everybody, with the whole experience of that first year, and it goes much deeper than Bill Simmons. People like to make it that shallow, and it's not. I cannot try to please the world and try to be everybody's buddy and best friend because it's impossible. And even if you do nothing wrong, there's people who aren't going to like you. You know, I was on The View once, and it was actually the first time, and I got in a fight with the ladies, kind of, because Sherry Shepherd at the time, she had read somewhere that I'm sensitive about this with my white mom. And Barbara Walters brought up, she's like, well, what happens when you fill out your census? What do you check? Because you can only check one. I said, well, I check two anyway, or I don't check anything, but I'm not going to choose. And she's like, well, the president, Barack Obama, he chooses black. And I was like, well, congratulations to him. I happen to think that's wrong.
Welcome to the SI Media Podcast, where each week we interview interesting members of the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Alan Kim. And this week, our guest is Sage Steele, the host of ESPN's NBA Countdown, a longtime anchor on SportsCenter. Sage joined that network in 2007 after stops in South Bend, Indianapolis, Tampa, and Washington, D.C. On this podcast, we're certainly going to talk about Countdown and how she prepares for that role, her relationship with the current members, her relationship with Bill Simmons and Magic Johnson. Sage has an interesting background. She's biracial. And so I think we'll get into her thoughts on racism in the business, particularly for someone who's biracial, gender issues in the business. I find Sage to be very honest. So I think this will be a pretty interesting conversation. We'll keep this intro short, and we'll bring on Sage Steele of ESPN. All right, Sage, let's start with this. The as you know, Countdown has had a lot of different formats over the years, from a traditional host, which, you know, whether it was Stuart Stiard or Mike Tirico, to not having a traditional host during the Wilbon era, where there was, you know, essentially just analysts, and Michael Wilbon may bring the show to break and bring it back. But generally speaking, there was no host. You have solidified that host role at the moment. And prior to doing this, you were doing SportsCenter. Your career was certainly going well. But the company asked you to do this job. You accepted it. It's a long way of asking, has hosting Countdown been a good move for you professionally? And if so, why?
It's been the absolute best move of my career. And I sometimes look back and laugh because I had never dreamt of this. SportsCenter was my end all be all. It was my dream since I was, you know, 12 years old and announced that I was going to work at ESPN. I announced it to my family at age 12. And then in college, you know, SportsCenter was what I did, you know, all night, watched 50 reruns. And so I had achieved my dream and my goal, and I had the perfect schedule for my family. I have three kids, and I mean, I did the 1 to 3 p.m. SportsCenter at the end there with David Lloyd, one of my best friends still. And the hours were such that I could get my kids on the school bus, and then I could be there when they got off the bus. So I really didn't miss anything, and it was perfect. And then this job offer came up, and I thought they were joking. And, you know, it was a no-brainer because of what it is, what the show is. And, again, I just was shocked because it had never been in my thought process. I was content. For the first time in my life, professionally, I was content. So, you know, but it's a no-brainer. You do it. Obviously, it happened. I mean, they changed the format, decided to change things up after Magic Johnson quit, like 3 weeks before the season began in 2013. Michael Wilbon had left the show as well a couple of months prior. So at that point, it's like, all right, let's change this up, you know, blow it up and bring a host in. And I've loved it. I mean, I've done, obviously, hosting before with analysts and guests, different from SportsCenter, but similar in many ways. And, you know, the hardest part about the job was accepting it because I lived in Connecticut and the job is based in Los Angeles. And so the travel was the one big concern. And that's the reason why I no longer live in Connecticut. I now live in Arizona. Didn't want to move to LA, you know, just a little too much for our small town Connecticut family. So it's a much easier flight, 1 hour versus 6 hours. And hey, I missed the miles. I missed the frequent flyer miles. I racked them up quickly. That was the biggest concern, though, was just being away from my family that much. And it really beat me up that first year. So we moved summer of 14.
So do you ever think about if Magic doesn't quit, how that changes the shape of your career?
Yeah. And the first time I saw Magic was All-Star Game in 2014 in New Orleans, I think. And I had seen him in forever, and I went up to him, and he's like, "Hey, girl, you're doing a good job." And I was like, I just need to thank you. And I said, the fact that you screwed the company has changed my life. Thank you so much. Because it was like a lot, you know, he did. He decided not to do the show just a couple weeks before, and they had to scramble. So no one probably in the entire network or fans or anybody was happy about that. I was the only happy person. I would love to have Magic on the show. I mean, he's Magic Johnson. I was bummed that he wasn't a part of it. But, you know, everything happens for a reason. And if he had stayed on, I don't know that they would have decided to go back to a host format. So, and Magic's been so supportive of me since this all happened too. I mean, he reaches out and he watches, and it means a lot to me that I have that kind of silent support from him. He's always watching everything, as you know, and that meant a lot.
It's interesting that he's still watching the show. One more on that. I think listeners would be interested. How does it work, like specifically in terms of somebody at ESPN? You know, Magic quits, the show is in a little bit of flux. So who do you get a call from? Is it an executive vice president saying X? Is it the producer of the show? Is it John Skipper? I think people would be really curious as to how it works when you get that call that really can game change your career.
Well, it's funny because I was hosting the ESPNW conference or summit, and I've hosted or emceed that. It's like a 2-3 day conference in California. I hosted that for the last 5 years. And so I was there doing my job, and Sarah Spain mentioned something in front of the audience, and she was like, "Hey, Magic quit." And I was like, "Oh, gosh. Anyway, what do I have to do next?" You know, like I thought, okay, because again, it was not on my radar. And then that evening, a lot of the execs were there. John Skipper was there, Don Wildhack was there, many of them. And I got an email from Wildhack that said, "Hey, can you meet me in the morning?" And I said, "Sure. I mean, I have to be on stage, you know, starting the day with for the summit at like 8:30. So he's like, "Meet in the lobby at 8 a.m. And this is at, the best resort, Dana Point. What is it? The St. Regis and Dana Point. Phenomenal. So I remember meeting in that lobby. And when I was back there this year too, it's like deja vu, because sitting in that one little table in the corner where I can see the Pacific Ocean is where John Wildhack said, basically offered me the job. And, you know, try to have poker face, because I was in a contract negotiation anyway. My deal was coming up. And so we were already negotiating based on, you know, sticking with what we all thought was going to be a sports center role and hopefully some other things too. So needless to say, I was shocked. And even when I heard Magic had quit the day before, I okay, that'll be interesting. This happens all the time. Maybe not with such, you know, big name talent like Magic, but you know, I was worried about emceeing the next couple of days and then going back home to my kids and going back on SportsCenter. So it was a shock. But yeah, Wildhack was like, "What do you think?" And I just tried to play it cool, though he knows me. And I just smiled. And then, then I tried to go on stage and focus. And I probably made no sense, but they asked me back the next year. So I must have faked it enough. And then, got in the car and headed to the airport. And actually, my husband was out of town and unreachable for a week. Like, he left town when I did to go host this, and he's a big hunter, and he was elk hunting in the mountains of Colorado. And again, we lived in Connecticut. And so I have to make this life-altering decision, and I couldn't get a hold of my husband. So needless to say, it was a crazy week. And at one point, when I had to go up to John Skipper's office to talk about this, he's like, "What's the delay with the decision here?" And I was like, "Well, I mean, my husband," he's like, he's in the mountains? What the heck? I was like, okay. So I'm having to just explain to the president of ESPN that I cannot make this decision without consulting with my husband first because he's trying to kill elk in the mountains of Colorado and I can't reach him. So it was an interesting, he looked at me like I was nuts. I was like, hey, that's my guy. He's providing food for the family, you know? So it was crazy. But I look back and it's one of those moments, you know, that whole week from the moment I got the offer to when I accepted it a week later. Like, I'll never forget that because it did really change my career.
That's the first elk hunting reference, I believe, for the Sports Illustrated Podcast Network, Sage. Congratulations
on that. You know you can count on me to shock you.
It's interesting. And then just to sort of follow up and finalize this. So how long does it take, basically, from an executive at ESPN offering you this to actually you agreeing? 2-week process, basically?
Well, the problem was they needed an answer now because it was so close to the beginning of the season. And they're down not one but two people, two huge names on that show with Magic and Wilbon. You know, Wilbon, I think, had left the show in August. And then this was, you know, early. Actually, it was October 11th. I remember the day because it was my brother's birthday. October 11th when Wildhack offered me the job, and the season usually starts on the 28th or so, right before Halloween. So they didn't have much time to figure this out for, you know, a prominent show that leads into, you know, the NBA finals and the league, you know, the league's thinking what the heck is going on probably. So they needed an answer right away. So there was a lot of pressure to get this done for ESPN, but that, and then therefore it trickled down to me. But obviously, you know, if it were just me and I were single, then I wouldn't have taken a full week to do it, which really isn't that much considering the type of negotiation that has to go into that. So, like I said, it was awkward to say, Mr. Skipper, I'm sorry. My husband's in the mountains. I can't reach him. So, but he understood. I mean, I have three children and my husband is a stay-at-home dad. Like, he kind of runs the house and I can't just say, yeah, I'm going to LA. It was crazy, but they understood. And I think they knew that obviously I wanted the job, but it had to be the right thing overall because it's not just me. There's four of the people that depend on me.
Yeah, good on ESPN to sort of to make that work, understanding your family situation. In terms of countdown, and this is a question we ask basically every guest, because there's, I think a lot of people have interest in process. More people are interested in broadcasters or writers and podcasters' process than I think the public might realize. So, Sage, on a day that you're hosting Countdown, let's say 7, 8 o'clock Eastern, starting from when you wake up, can you take the listeners through what that day is like and what you're doing to prepare for that show?
Yeah, I mean, I actually like that I don't live in the same town where the show is broadcast from, because when I'm on the road, it's just so much easier for me to focus. And yeah, I used to have guilt for that, for thinking like that, you know, oh, I should be home, but I'll come in the night before. I'll come in from Phoenix the night before to LA. And so then I can wake up and I try to work out right away. I've been pretty terrible lately, but just to get going, get the juices flowing. Before I do that, I mean, literally the first thing is I roll out of, I don't even roll out of bed before I check my phone and read Twitter. And I need to stop that. I need to, like, you know, pee first or something before I start reading Twitter. Like, it's okay. You can wait 60 seconds. But I just get right into it and see, you know, I watch the games the night before as much as I can. I watch NBA Tonight on our network. I watch NBA TV. They've got that great half hour recap show of every game. So, you know, just to make sure I'm up to date and then start reading, go work out, shove some food down my throat. And then I just kind of read it more and more. I mean, that's the beauty of the technology age that we're in now, where I look back to when I started my career 20 years ago. I'm like, what did we do? How did we get this in? I don't even remember. So there's just so many different ways to get it and get it quickly online. And then, you know, I go in at about, I want to say 12:30. And I just go right to makeup, get it done with, because I don't like to think about it and want it over with. I want to totally focus until we go on live at 4 p.m. I'm talking Pacific time, by the way. Sorry.
It's okay.
So I've got about three, four hours in studio tops probably before I go in. But we have our meeting, and, you know, the meetings have evolved a little bit, because at first, my first year, everybody kind of, you know, as you know, it's a kind of a tightly run ship, all of these shows at ESPN, and it's very highly produced. And we're trying to get away from that. And I know it's a difficult thing for ESPN to do, trying to get away from that. So it's starting in our, you know, and we're in a different world in LA. It's just us. And then the 1 a.m. Sports Center people, all the execs in the suits are really back east. So we kind of have a little more flexibility, I think, to kind of just do what we want, so to speak. Not that you can't in Bristol, but obviously there's more cooks in the kitchen there. So now the meetings are really quick, and we don't really want to hear what the analysts are going to say. I don't want to hear it either, because I want to have a genuine reaction to what their answers are. They know what the topics are going to be. And, you know, Jalen and Doug have talked separately to the producers, because we like to do breakdown tapes at times. And actually, that's a huge part of what we do and why we are so different from Turner, I think, one of the many reasons. It is still highly produced. But I think the most important part for me, and this goes back to being on SportsCenter and my whole career, and I've been criticized for it at times, even from producers at ESPN, I want it to be conversational. My goal is for us to forget that there's cameras and forget that we have microphones on and just talk basketball. And will I ever fully achieve that in this job? No, but that's always my goal. And I say no, just because that's not how ESPN really works. It is definitely more scripted. But my favorite TV of any kind, entertainment, you know, sports, politics, is when people are having a conversation, not question, answer, graphic, answer, go to break. So we're trying to get out of that. And I think we've come a long way just this year. It's hard because we don't have that many shows at the beginning of the year. Really, until the calendar changes, we don't have enough shows. We've been off now, I think, since the week before Thanksgiving, and we don't go back on until Friday, December 18th. So that's like a month. And it's a long time to not be together with your team and really to continue to build that chemistry. So I look forward to the calendar year changing, and then we go hard all the way through June.
Sage, in your position, how does someone get better as a studio host? Is it reps or is it something else?
Well, for me, it's reps. And I will say this. I mean, I'm always still nervous before every show. A lot of people can tell with me because, first of all, I talk too fast anyway. My dad's been telling me since I was 12 and announced that I wanted to work at ESPN that, sweetheart, if you want to do this, you better slow down. I've slowed down so much. And I know it doesn't sound like it, especially when I'm excited on the air, but it's a genuine, genuine thing because I love what I'm doing and I love the job. And so I still get those nerves, which to me is good. And it means that I care and I've got that adrenaline rush, as long as it doesn't go overboard, and it's a fine line. For me, it's the reps, and what has come with that is just confidence and knowing that even if I really don't have a plan for what I'm going to say in the B block, something hopefully semi-smart will come out. And the reps is what has done that for me, is just continue to do it again and again and again. Watching yourself sucks. I hate watching myself. I hate it. Always have, always will. But I've had to do that the past few years on this show for sure. And you know, one of the things for me is to listen to the people that are in my life, family and friends, versus just producers and bosses. Because I think they're the viewers. They're the ones that, yes, we're trying to please our bosses, but I mean, ratings go up, not thanks to our bosses or our producers or, you know, me, it's thanks to the viewers. And if they think that we're doing a decent job, numbers go up, everybody watches, we all win, you know? So I really listen to them. I listen to more the layman's breakdown of my show because that's our demographic. So I do listen to Twitter, and I hate it in many ways, but I do love it. And I think it's important to know. I wrote back to somebody the other day. I'm like, it's good to know the hate that's out there and what people are saying. Sometimes they make really good points. Other times they don't, but at least you know, and at least you stay grounded. For me, it has really kept me grounded, and I personally don't think I have an issue with that just because of how I was raised and the accountability that my parents raised me with. I'll never get a big head. It's just all there is to it. I would never be allowed to. That's one of the issues I have with this industry and the people in it. There's so many people who fall in love with themselves and get too caught up in being recognized and making a little bit of money. It's like, God, remember where you came from? A lot of people don't. I just feel fortunate that I have people in my life who bring me back down. And I really think it's important to listen to others, not just the people that you work with, to continue to get better.
So do you think in your position, you should have a say in who is an analyst around you?
I could have a what?
I said, do you think as the host of your show, should you have a say in who the company hires as an analyst around you?
Should I versus what I want to? First of all, I would love to. Why not? I would challenge you to find one person who would say, no, I don't care, put anyone on. Because we all want to win. We all want to make it the best possible. So I would love to. Should I? Maybe. I haven't thought about it that way because it's just not, it's not reality for me, you know, and for really any of us at ESPN. I mean, actually probably a couple, never mind. But not me. And that's okay because I'm not there yet. And I don't know that I fully earned that yet. And I don't know, it's very subjective. I don't know what would make me earn it. But why not? Because if the chemistry works, it's just going to be better TV. I'm just trying to get better, every time and work with the people that I'm with. And I really like the people that I'm with. I mean, I really do. And I think this is kind of just year two of the three of us. And, you know, last year was like year one again, you know? We're starting over. We're starting from scratch. And so repetition, that's how we all get better, by, yes, doing it, but by being with each other. I think that's crucial.
A couple more about Countdown, and then we'll move to others. By the way, I like that there's stuff going on in your house behind you, Sage. We're not editing that
Never.
Out, just so you know.
I'm sorry.
We're keeping that in.
Life.
It's real life. In terms of the current group that you have, you find that this year, in your second year with the group, there's more chemistry than the first year?
Absolutely. I can't tell you how excited I was after our first preseason show, which I think was an hour. It was just fun. And I got off the set beaming and almost emotional because I'm like, oh my God, it's going to be a good year. And, there's just been so much change and ups and downs and just physically the travel. And we had, you know, personally, we had moved out west. And so I wasn't going to be beaten up with that, the red eyes constantly. And most importantly, though, is how we felt during the show in the commercial break. And in that first commercial break, we were like high-fiving and fist bumping because we knew we were rolling and we hadn't seen each other since June, since the finals. So, I don't know. I have such a good gut right now, and that's comforting to have a good gut. And that doesn't mean it's always going to work out, and that doesn't mean there's not going to be issues because, oh, by the way, there are always issues, and there's no such thing as perfect, especially in this stupid business. So I don't know. I feel like we've already come such a long way, but we have so far to go, Richard, so far. And I'll always say that, though. I always will. Hopefully, you know, not as much. It won't be as much of a focus. Oh, we got to get better here or there. That's what happens. That's why Turner is Turner. And that show is that show. It's so good because Ernie and Chuck have been together for what, 16? This is their 17th season?
Something like that, yeah.
You can't get worse when you are able to establish that kind of chemistry. There's no way. So I'm envious of that. And, I've had that a couple of times in my career, obviously not at this level because I've never been at this level before, but we're getting better every time. And most importantly, we're all in and we support each other. And that's I think it's unique.
Sage, it's very obvious that you can even tell through your voice that the chemistry between you, Jalen, and Doug, you really like. I know you're very close with Jalen and you have been for a long time. You know, I could sort of read between the lines that obviously you're getting along with Doug, at least on set. All this to me is a subtext to ask you a question I think you know I have to ask. And that is, for the first year of the show, there, you know, whether it's reading online, whether it's reading between the lines, I think there was a thought that, at least on the air, there was a conflict between you and Bill Simmons. So I will ask you directly, how would you define your relationship with Bill on Countdown during your tenure together?
I think it's a good question because it just the way you asked it. Listen, I'm going to be really honest with you. And when I came on the show, and again, it was last second, pretty sure the remaining people on the show, Bill and Jalen, did not green light me or, you know, were asked about, you know, whether or not I'd be the preferred choice, because again, that's not what ESPN does. Bosses make the decisions and then we all kind of take our marching orders. So, but I didn't know anything. I just knew that I had this great offer and it's NBA, which I love. And I loved Jalen from when I covered him with the Indiana Pacers in the mid-90s. He and I are like the exact same age. And I, you know, was thrilled to be able to talk trash with him about Indiana versus Michigan. And I'd never met Doug, but I respected Doug tremendously. Who doesn't in the basketball world? And then I respected Bill tremendously because who doesn't as far as him as a journalist and what he's done? I mean, it's awesome. I met him for the first time at the Upfronts. And maybe it was 13 or 12. I don't know. The year I hosted with Greeny, I don't remember. And I didn't know Bill. And so I was thrilled to get to know Bill and Doug because I didn't know them. And, I just didn't know. I didn't know that there, forgive me, but I didn't live online and I didn't know that there was, tension even before I got there. So, I mean, it's probably good. You know, I mean, I kind of get along with everybody. And I think that's the part maybe in the end that I was confused about because I, you know, I'm an Army brat. I was raised moving across the world, four different countries. Like if you're going to survive, you have to be outgoing and friendly and a teammate. And that's all I knew. So that's what I went to do. And that's all I can say is that I tried to be the best teammate to everybody. I had some really awesome moments with Bill. In particular, I would hope he would say this too, during the playoffs when we were in Miami and San Antonio, of course, but of course more fun in Miami, no offense, Texas. But we stayed at the Mandarin, and I'm pretty sure Bill got that done. We're like, thank you, Bill, Mandarin's the best. And so he would work out and walk around the water and, you know, so I think it's, what is that? Whatever fancy area down there starts with B. And he'd go to Starbucks. And so we were talking about working out and I joined him one time and then we would go all the time whenever we're in Miami, you know, conference finals and finals and take walks and talk about our kids and about the business. And at that time I was doing some stuff on The View and, you know, and obviously he has tons of connections in the entertainment world with Kimmel. And so I don't know, we had some awesome talks. He's a great dad. He loves those kids. His daughter is a badass. Like she, you know, I mean, and he's always showing pictures of his daughter and I was showing him pictures of my kids. And so I don't know. I learned a lot. He's so darn creative. I really don't regret anything because here's the thing. All I know is that I controlled what I could control. And trust me, I've thought a lot about all this. And that was to go and be the best teammate that I can, because I knew that I was the new kid on the block and I didn't want to walk in there, be like, oh, here I am. I'm the host. Cause anyone who knows me knows that that's not my personality, maybe to a fault sometimes. And maybe it was too much on the other side when I took that job. But I just wanted to go in and show that I'm all in and excited. And, I read stuff, but I try to just take it all with a grain of salt because you don't know what's true and what's not true. At the end of the day, I don't exactly know what happened, but I'm really at peace with it because I have to be. Because I know that I went in and I did my best, most importantly as a host. And it was a tough challenge looking back to be on the set with three very different men, three very different analysts, two of whom I didn't know. There's always egos involved. You know, and trying to split up the time. And, you know, we have 22 minutes after commercial breaks. So you're trying to get three very knowledgeable, opinionated people in there, and there's traffic jams sometimes. That's my job, is I got to direct traffic and listen to the producer and also listen to what they're saying and try to react properly. And that's why I love it. It's a challenge. And hey, obviously not everybody agreed with how things were done, but I know, yeah, I mean, as far as produced and maybe even how I did things, I was never told that though. And I really believe that I know that I gave it my all that year. I did my best. I tried my hardest, maybe even too hard, to just lay low and be a good teammate and be a human being, because that's what I am first. And someday when all this is over, you know, I'm still going to be that person, that army brat, that kid who just, you know, wanted to be a teammate and please. And most importantly, I'm still going to be a mom of three kids and hopefully a wife too. So all this, I've maintained perspective because I've got a lot more important things in my life. Yeah, there were some hurtful things going on, but I didn't know they were going on until after. I was so naive. I just didn't know. So I learned a lot. Most importantly, I learned that, and I mean, not just I'm with everybody, with the whole experience of that first year. And it goes much deeper than Bill Simmons. People like to make it that shallow, and it's not, because there's a whole team involved. But I'm at probably the best point in my life right now, because I realized over these last 2 years that I got to take care of me. I don't mean that selfishly. I mean, I cannot try to please the world and try to be everybody's buddy and best friend, because it's impossible. And even if you do nothing wrong, there's people who aren't going to like you. And so now I really like my 40s. I just turned 43. Damn it. I wish I did. I could have had this perspective 10, 15 years ago, but I'm really good. I'm finally okay with the fact that not everybody's going to like me. And that's on them. Unless I do something wrong, that's on them. And sometimes there might be legitimate reasons, but many times probably not. And that's their own issue. And I'm really happy that I've finally been able to mature enough to realize that and to be like, okay, I did my best. That's their loss.
Sage, I won't belabor this. I have one follow-up question on this, and then we will go on to another topic. And I appreciate you answering the question on Bill. I like you both. And I'll just finish with this. How interested would you be in sitting down with him one day? This is obviously away from the cameras, away from everybody else, and just having a post-mortem on what happened that first year.
I mean, I've never even thought of that, because I think it's pointless, because it's in the past. Honestly, I'm really being honest. I mean, if we were out at a party somewhere and I saw him, or a restaurant, I mean, I don't know, I would 100% go up, because I mean, that's who I am. And sometimes, you know, one of the things that how we were raised, with my dad and his background and military and West Point, and forgive me for being cheesy, but it's one of the only ways I've been able to get through some tough times in life. And that is part of the cadet prayer. Help me to choose the harder right, not the easier wrong. And it's harder to address things. It's harder to go up and start think conversations that might be uncomfortable. It's harder to do many things that we know deep down are right. I don't know what the right thing is in this situation, but I do know that I had some awesome times in that first year, even though I was scared to death half the time, scared of if I was doing a well enough job, if he liked me, if Jalen liked me, if Doug liked me, if the producers liked me, if the bosses liked me, if the viewers liked me, if the NVA liked me. I mean, oh my God, it was exhausting. And then you start to learn about the politics, but I was already in, you know, I signed the contract and, you know, I thought, good God, I didn't realize there was all this. So, at the end of the day, I have zero ill will towards him, because, I think you learn from everything, if you're willing to open your mind to learn. And he is brilliant. I learned a lot from him. I will always read and listen to him, because he's good and he's funny. And I got to know the other side of him, which, I mean, not deep, but with what his family means to him. And to me, that's so important. Maybe we all handle things differently. You know, we probably couldn't be more different in that way. I handle things much differently than he does, but that's okay. So I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if he, I don't know. At the end of the day, he's really happy from what I've heard, and I'm thrilled for him. And I'm really happy too. And at the end of the day, we should all be thanking God, if you believe in God, I tend to, thanking God that we are able to do this for a living. And there's going to be some arguments and there's going to be some ugliness and some fights. At the end of the day, let's keep perspective. We're talking about basketball for a living. And it's not a bad living. I just think that sometimes we need to all take a deep breath and realize that, and maybe, you know, treat people the way you want to be treated. That's what I try to do. But I'm thrilled for him, and hopefully he is for me too. But if not, it's okay. Again, I have bigger things in my life than work.
You both are rich, healthy, and fairly young. You should both be very, very happy.
Yeah, I think you're right. We're, I don't know about rich. I know healthy, and I don't know about young, but healthy.
Oh, I said I was being nice. I said fairly young for both of you guys.
Fairly, kind of, yeah.
Exactly. All right, let's take a quick break with Sage Deal of ESPN, and we'll be back right after this. All right, for people who are NBA fans, they know it's been an unbelievable season. Check out the Warriors, for instance. The Bucks ended their win streak in remarkable fashion, but that team is a joy to watch, from Steph Curry's absurd shooting, Klay Thompson's absurd shooting. They play unselfish basketball. Draymond Green is always fun, maybe not for the refs. But the NBA has just been really, really interesting this year. And SeatGeek is the best way for you to find a great deal into getting to see NBA games and many other games from other sports. When you use my code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, you get $20 back via check or PayPal. Here's how it works. On SeatGeek, you can also sell your extra tickets to other fans. SeatGeek pulls all the ticket buying and selling options from other ticket sites into one place to save you time. They know the fair market value of every ticket. SeatGeek uses that information to show you the best deals and find the underpriced seats in a venue. Also, if you have tickets you can't use, SeatGeek will help you quickly sell them to another fan. Do you hate those sneaky fees at the end for ticket buying? SeatGeek has the lowest fees of any ticket site out there and always shows you the full price up front. So, to redeem your promo code and get your $20 rebate via check or PayPal, download the free SeatGeek app today and enter promo code MEDIA in the app. SeatGeek will then send you $20 once you've made your first SeatGeek purchase. So, for any sporting tickets you want, use the SeatGeek app, and don't forget to enter our code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, for $20 back. All right, back with Sage Steele of ESPN. Sage, I'm correct that you, your parents, you come from a biracial family. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Do you classify yourself as biracial or something else?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mixed, biracial.
Okay.
Yeah, half black, half white. Yep.
That's right. The reason I'm asking that, I just want to be clear with my language for the subject is, and I'll now ask the question. You are a mixed race woman in a predominantly white male field. How much racism have you faced professionally during your career?
Well, I think looking back now, again, being the wise, grizzly old age of 43, I can look back and point to some moments. In many ways, I'm really glad that I was naive and kind of clueless. in the military, one of the things that I realize now is as diverse as the military is, and if you think about it, and there's a ton of interracial marriages in the military. I lived in Greece. I lived in Belgium. I was born in Panama. I lived in 6 other states. I can't remember. Like, you move around, and I would go to Paris for the day with my Girl Scout troop, and I would complain. You know, my 3rd grade field trip was to the Acropolis. Okay.
Like, nice.
I lived in Greece. And so then I come back to Bristol, Connecticut. My kids are going to the trash museum for field trips. I'm like, really? This is fancy. Point being, it's a diverse, amazing lifestyle. However, it's also on the other spectrum, it's sheltered. You're sheltered because everyone in the military is so accepting. And that's what I didn't realize. So then my dad got out of the military, and then I went to college, and okay, people aren't as accepting as they are in our little army world. And so it took me a long time to realize what it was. I thought, well, what's up with that? Gosh, I'm really nice. Why would they? So yeah, I've experienced it. a couple of times it's been, you know, particularly hurtful because it came from people who I thought were friends. One guy, I set up him and his wife, and they were, I was in their wedding and they were in my wedding. And he was in the business, and I found out later that he was telling people that the only reason I got a certain job years ago before ESPN was because not only was I a female, but I was a Black female. And you know how Black people, and at the end of the day, I don't know, maybe he was right. I'd like to think it was more than just me helping the HR department, you know, look more diverse. But there were a lot of things said, and that's really, you know, surface level there with that one. But I've experienced it. I just feel like, you know, again, I can't change the world. I can't change people's opinions. This is America. They can think what they want. I have a choice as to whether or not I let it affect me. And I think I did for a while, and I don't now. Just with what I was saying before about people not liking me, I got nothing for you. It's out there. It always will be. But I do know that at this point, I probably wouldn't have gotten to this level based just on, you know, people trying to be more diverse.
What's interesting to me, and when I when you were going to be on, I wanted to ask you this, obviously, because your, you know, your parents, I think your parents are white and Black. Is that correct?
Yeah, my mom's white. She's half Irish, half Italian. My dad's Black.
Okay, and you are part of an interracial marriage as well. You're Black. You're, well, actually, I shouldn't say you're Black. You are, as you just said, mixed.
Yeah, and you're, careful.
I apologize for that. And your husband is white.
So, yeah, he's white. So yeah, go ahead.
All right. So this leads me. And by the way, your family, by the way, is a you're truly a 21st century family, which I think is very cool, and which is the way our world is heading. But you're in sports, and knowing your interesting and unique background, I wanted to ask you, how much do you think a sports audience cares about the race of broadcasters, if they care at all?
You know, the only time I ever hear about it is from young Black women or Black parents who say thank you because there's so few of you out there, especially women, Black women. I really only hear about it in a positive way. Now, I'm not as naive, and I realize that there's going to be stuff out there, you know, and people are. But again, I can't control them letting go of it. However, it's funny because I am sensitive to being called Black because I'm also white, actually right down the middle, 50%. And obviously, you know, when I'm on TV and if you're at a restaurant and you look up and you're not going to say, oh yeah, look at that white girl with curly hair. No, you're going to say, look at the Black girl with curly hair. She's just maybe lighter skin. So I know what it is. I know how I am quote unquote defined just visually when I'm on someone's television screen. But you know, I was on The View once, and it was actually the first time, and I got in a fight with the ladies, kind of, because Sherry Shepherd at the time, she had read somewhere that I am sensitive about this with my white mom. And Barbara Walters brought up, she's like, well, what happens when you fill out your census? What do you check? Because you can only check one. I said, well, I check two anyway, or I don't check anything, but I'm not going to choose. And she's like, well, the president, Barack Obama, he chooses Black. And I was like, well, congratulations to him. I happen to think that's wrong. He can do what he wants. But, you know, I believe his white mom was there at birth, as was mine. And for him, I think his white grandmother helped raise him as well. And the Black father was nowhere to be found. So to each his own, truly. However, for me, it is really important that my white mom is part of this as well. I mean, she carried me again. She was there. And I just don't, I hate that we have to choose. I don't know. It is what it is. We're not going to ever fully get past this in our society anywhere in the world. But I'm proud of being biracial. I feel like I have the best of both worlds. My mother is half Irish, half Italian. My grandmother's name was Philomena Lena Di Pertola. Okay. a little bit Italian. My grandfather was William Edward O'Neill. You know, I mean, O'Neill is my mom's maiden name. And I love that when we all get together, and it's pretty rare, but people that we don't know who the hell goes with whom, because all these different colors, and this is what happens. You start mixing races, Richard, you never know. And so there's been family photos. We've had professional photographers come and they're like, can you help me here? I don't know who's with whom. And you know, there's like, the ratio of white people to black people is a little bit off here. And I don't know. So we have fun with it, you know, but I have the best of both worlds. I really do. I've been criticized for it and for talking too white. I mean, it's hysterical, some of the things that people come up with. But I remember Barbara, again, on The View, just being mortified that I didn't choose black. And I'm like, listen to you. Like, that's actually racist if you want to go there. They just couldn't stand it. They couldn't stand that I wasn't choosing black.
It's interesting because, first of all, it's absolutely a personal choice as to how you define your own race, especially on a census form.
Yeah.
But what's interesting to me, though, as someone who's growing up biracial, you make this declaration to your parents at 12 that you want to be on SportsCenter. Oftentimes when we want to go into a profession, we need role models, even if they're not in our neighborhood, we're watching them on TV or, you know, like for my case, I might've been reading them in a newspaper or a magazine. So was there anybody on television and in sports television that you could role model? There certainly were not many African-American women on the air. I mean, maybe Robin Roberts at SportsCenter, and that's at least in high profile sports. Jane Kennedy, a little bit at CBS, but clearly, I mean, there's still not many black women in high profile positions, and certainly not back then. Obviously, there were white broadcasters, but they were also generally speaking relegated to the sidelines and stuff. For a young biracial girl growing up who wants to be on SportsCenter, who, if anybody, are you looking at as a role model?
Well, there was nobody that looked like me, certainly, you know, back then in the 80s when I decided I wanted to do this. Later, it was Robin Roberts, of course, and not just her because she, you know, I looked like her, had the same skin color, but because of how she was and how she conducted herself on the air. I didn't know anything about her behind the scenes. But on the air, I just thought, gosh, what a pro. And she seemed so genuine and conversational, which again has always been my goal. And maybe that's one of the reasons why, is because I always thought she was so conversational, even when you're talking about difficult topics. So she was the one, but otherwise, I mean, I didn't have many, you know, as far as women that I looked up to when I was younger in the industry, Robin's at the top of the list. And I'm talking just about, again, watching people and how they do their jobs, not necessarily personalities or anything, because I didn't know any of that. I always thought Bonnie Bernstein was phenomenal. She's just, I don't know, 3 or 4 years older than me, not much, but she was doing so much at such a young age. I thought Bonnie was phenomenal. And I ended up having a lot of male mentors. And again, there weren't many black male sportscasters. And all my sports departments, I was certainly the only one, even in the overall newsrooms, you know. In Indianapolis, I was the first female sportscaster there, I think, ever. You know, I did get a lot of, you know, hate mail and letters and comments when I was in Indianapolis, I will say. I think they were a little behind in many ways. But I also, some of the racism I did experience, I guess, was through my peers, to be honest with you, a couple of people in particular in the business who didn't think, you know, black woman belonged there. So, again, I was naive to so much of it, and thank goodness for Robin in that way, for just being there and doing it so beautifully, you know, from the beginning.
Sage, what's it like for you on social media? In terms of, you know, whether you want to sort of go down, you know, see the interesting thing there is that I remember talking to Jemele Hill about this, and it was twofold for her. And again, I recognize that you classify yourself as biracial, it's still sort of the same issue in that Jemele would not only get it on a gender end on social media, she certainly got it on a racial end. And I remember one time during the podcast, which stunned me, she told me that there essentially was not a day that went by on Twitter where somebody didn't drop the N-word on her. And if she, maybe it's gotten better, maybe it's not, but at a certain point she said, if you really start taking that to heart every day, you'd be crying all day and just never going online. So she sort of learned how to deal with trolls and to deal with it. You know, you're in a different position. You're not as much of an opinionist as Jemele. So,
So
you're going to get different kind of comments, especially on social media, but still, you're a recognizable face on that network. What is social media like for you, both good and bad?
It has evolved, certainly, and I think I have evolved with it, which was necessary because I, at first, I didn't even want to do it. and they were encouraging us at ESPN. I mean, they encouraged me at least to get on and try it. And, you know, I was like, who the hell wants to know what I think about anything? There's no way they really care, because my job is not to give my opinion. That's different for Jamel. It's much tougher for her in that way. I'm, trust me, dying to give my opinion about a plethora of things, of topics, but that's not my job. And so, you know, I didn't get it. Now I do. I see the positive side of it, and how, I mean, business-wise, brand-wise, obviously news and what you can get. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, Richard, there was an earthquake here in Arizona, and it was the middle of the night. I was like, what the heck? And we ran around the house, realized what it was. I thought, my husband goes to Google it, and I go on Twitter. Well, Jerry Harris by a bunch of people who I follow, and earthquake. My husband, you know, it takes 15 minutes to go. So, like, thank God for Twitter. I knew it was confirmed. We had an earthquake here in Scottsdale, thanks to Twitter. So, like, the benefits of it, that sounds silly, but it's true. The benefits of it are tremendous. The negatives are pretty ugly. And I finally, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I was responding to somebody who said something just rude. It wasn't gross or racist, or it was just rude. And so I responded, and Mike Tirico, he texts me. He's like, stop it. Stop pushing send. Do not engage. Do not engage. And I'm like, oh gosh, Mike's watching. He always looks out for me. I love that man. He's a true friend, most importantly. And he looks out for me. He's like, stop it. And I go, no. I have to finish this. I have to finish this with this idiot. So I'm much better. I don't do that as much. Because it's not worth it, and you're not going to change these people. My husband, and this is inappropriate, my husband calls them finger sniffers. These people who sit in their basement, in their mom's basement, and, like, you know, remember Saturday Night Live, what's her name? And she, remember, help me, what's her name?
Somebody in
SNL. And she'd, you know, she'd put her fingers in her armpits and then smell her face. Like, those people, those gross people who have no life. I'm not making sense there. You don't know. You don't remember that part of SNL?
Alan and I are Mary Catherine Gallagher, maybe, or no? Does that sound right?
Yeah. Or, no, it's like from 10 years ago. Oh, her name's on the tip of my tongue.
Yeah,
she's
it's
in
her.
Movies.
Yeah, no, it's, okay. It's her. Who played Mary Catherine Gallagher, Alan? I just let this roll. All right, keep talking, Sage, and we'll figure
okay,
this out.
Okay, I'm going to – wait, it wasn't Tina Fey doing it? Anyway.
Molly Shannon, maybe?
It was Molly Shannon. Yes.
There we go.
Right? That was, I loved that scene on SNL. So these are people who, that analogy maybe, who don't have a life and who are in their mom's basement and are 40 years old and commenting and telling you what a terrible human being you are, or how ugly you are, or how much you suck on TV. So you got to keep perspective as to who is taking the time to reach out and write you and say rude, ugly, untrue, or maybe true things. Get a life. So I'm much better with it. I think it'd be much harder if I were in Jamel's shoes. When you are a columnist, an analyst, you know, you're paid to give your opinion, that's very, very different. And Jamel doesn't hold back, and I love her for it. And she goes hard on race topics, and a lot of people don't want to hear it. You know, I will say, sometimes I think we go too hard on race, and people try to create too much. Again, my opinion, even though I'm supposedly not allowed to have one. So it's different for her. But I'm in a good place with Twitter. I don't do as much as I should as far as posting stuff or checking. I'm into Instagram, frankly, a lot more than Twitter. I get my news on Twitter, post some stuff, but then I'm more me on Instagram.
First of all, you're allowed to have an opinion on this podcast, because that is indeed what you should be doing. One last one on Twitter. You know, you... because you're 43, you're not in the business in your mid-20s when social media has blown up. I wonder, you could either personalize this and say how you would have handled that, or you can sort of look outward and think about the women who have to deal with this. But my guess is that I know this for a fact, but a lot of 20-something women who are in prominent positions in the sports media not only get it on a gender end on Twitter, but get a lot of sexualized comments. For you, you probably still get them, but I think it would be obviously different if you were 25, 27. Have you ever talked about that with colleagues, or do you have a sense of how bad that is or is not for women in their 20s right now in high-profile positions, let's say on television like you are?
Well, I think it depends on the person And I think it depends on how the person chooses to portray themselves. And there are women out there, in my opinion, who are 25 or 30 or 40 or 45 or 50 who choose to portray themselves in a certain way and are just fine going out there with the shortest, tightest possible dresses and skirts and clothes. And okay, no one, I would never get online and write anything and critique specifically someone's outfit. I mean, I'm saying if I were a viewer and not in this job, but when, and I said this, I say this when I speak at colleges and universities, when women and men ask me about some of the little important parts of the industry, especially with where we are today, you know, young women, it's not an accident. We all know what we're wearing and what we're putting on, what clothes we're wearing. So, you know, when you look at some of the young women and what they choose to wear, I'm like, okay, you're bringing it on. And I'm not saying these guys are right for some of the things they say. I'm never going to defend that. But when you choose to put those kind of clothes on, when you know you're going to be sitting on a stool and in a studio and everything's going to be showing, well, then, you know, takes two. It takes two. And the guys aren't going to say anything in the first place if you, and sometimes they are. But I just think we have to be responsible as women. Is how do you want to be portrayed? Because by the way, hey, I wear tight-fitting clothes sometimes. If I do, I try to make them longer. It depends on the outfit. It depends on the location, time, and place. And most importantly, you know, how do you want to be perceived? Are you out there to be a journalist, broadcaster, or are you out there to show how hot and sexy you are? Like, to each his own, honestly. I've stopped. I think I used to judge women who did that. And I don't, again, maybe just maturity, because go for it, girl, go get it. But don't complain when you get a million other comments about other things besides what you're trying to talk about, sports, news, politics, because we are very aware. This is a visual medium, and we're all too smart to say, oh, I didn't know it would look like that on TV. So I just think we need to own it a little bit better as women.
Does the this is both for men and women. Does the pressure, does the looks-based pressure on television ever go away? At a certain point, can you, and I hope this is the case, but when you feel that you are established and you feel that people, the viewers are really, they're watching you for content and nothing beyond that. Does the pressure ever go away, or is the pressure always there? And I understanding that the pressure is far different for women than men, because the industry still is filled with men. And generally speaking, it's men making the decisions about who to put on the air and not women.
No, I don't think it ever goes away. Not now. Not anymore. You know, I will say I've become more comfortable. Last Friday, I was in the studio with Chauncey, and who I love, Chauncey Billups. I'm so glad he's part of the team. And I had actually flown across country from Baltimore that morning to L.A., and then really come straight to work. And listen, my hair is a hot topic quite often because it's different and it's big and it's natural. It is what it is. And after being on a plane for 6 hours, it just wasn't pretty. And so I put it back and put it in some ponytail holder, and was it cute? Oh no, it was not cute at all. But I'm like, you know what? It is what it is. It's all I got. I'm going to go. Now, a couple years ago, I probably would have been like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? Am I doing a good job? Do I know my facts? Am I setting Chauncey up well? You know, like, you just have to focus on what you can control at some point. And, but with looks, listen, it's tough, especially as you age. I mean, I've really tried to take some notes because I'm not getting any younger. These birthdays, for some reason, keep coming. And so, as I age, how do I want to age? Because people are watching and younger women are watching. And so it's never going to go away, but I'm trying to do it gracefully. You know, listen, I work hard to eat well and stay in decent shape. Not great, but decent for me, for my job, also for my three kids. I want them to see that you have to care. You don't have to look perfect, but you have to care. And you have to try to is to be healthy. And if you try to be healthy, other good things are hopefully going to come with that. So it'll never go away. There are certain makeup artists that I really don't want to touch my face because I don't like the makeup that they do. I look like I belong on a street corner. So yes, I care. I want the best makeup artist because that sets me up. And if you, I don't care what kind of job you have. When you walk into that boardroom, that interview, if you're working retail at the mall, when you feel like you look good, you stand taller. You're more confident. You speak better. And that those things are kind of important on TV. So it's a fine line between going overboard. I've always said I'm never going to get surgery. I'm never going to do any of that stuff. I have colored my hair for the past decade because I'm 100% gray. I've been gray since I was in my 20s. And if I don't go every 3 weeks, then I'm 100% white. I'm not exaggerating. White hair. That's the one thing I've had to care about. A boss said to me 10 years ago at my old job, listen, love you. You're in your early 30s. This is not a good look. And I was like, well, it is what it is. I mean, I can't change this. He's like, yeah, you can. You can color your hair. I go, no, I'm not. That is expensive. I am not going to pay to color my hair. And he said, I'll pay for it. I'm like, okay. So I started coloring my hair 10 years ago because of the gray. And if I didn't, I would look 20 years older than I already am. Not good. So you have to care, but you have to be comfortable with you. And I'm comfortable with me and all the imperfections and my big hair, which I refuse to straighten. I'll do it once a year, even though bosses for years have said, please straighten it. Please straighten it. I have more important things to do. And also, you know, again, I'm trying to be a good example for my kids and not to go fix everything that you don't love on yourself, although I happen to like my hair.
Well, three kids, first of all, will turn anybody's hair. Three young kids will turn anybody's hair gray.
Exactly. That's why I drink red wine, though. Red wine.
Exactly. And now, actually, after you said all that, Sage, Alan, Kim, and I feel horrible that we did not prepare at all makeup-wise for this podcast. We pretty much just walked in, although we did have free massages at SI yesterday, which was pretty nice.
What?
Felt like a little television felt like
they give you massages?
We had we had someone come in, thanks to Alan, in fact, to give the staff some massages. They were actually trying to drum up business, but it's pretty nice. I'm not going to lie.
Look at you, little metrosexual, yeah, asking like, for makeup and massages. How do your toes look right now?
Got to be honest with you. I felt like I was working for ESPN or Fox for a couple hours.
Stop it.
Pretty nice. All right, we're going to finish it. Sage has given us a lot of time, so we'll finish up with, we'll go back to the NBA, Sage. And, you know, now that you've been in the league for a couple of years and covered it, I think people would find it interesting we'll do it quick and go off the top of your head. Who have you really found to be very media friendly in terms of players and coaches and why?
Players and coaches. And I'm glad you prefaced that because I hadn't been one-on-one with NBA teams or anything for years, especially 5 years of SportsCenter. You're in studio, you know? So I've loved getting out. I feel like that's where I'm my best, by the way, is out and about and at games and live shots versus in a sterile studio. So, sorry, segue. Steve Kerr's been awesome, but that's what you would expect, you know? I think he was pretty good as a player and then obviously as an exec and then in broadcasting him, he's just, it's so refreshing. You know who one of my favorite players is that people always go, really? As me being a member of the media, is Russell Westbrook.
It's interesting.
And he's not a fan of us, of the media in general. But if you can get to know him a little bit, if he'll let you in, and he hasn't let me in that much, but enough to know that I'm a human being and I have a different job. I'm not an insider trying to break news. I did that back in the day and no, thank you. So it's easier. It's probably a little easier for them to maybe trust me, versus other true reporters because I'm getting info, but it's not a competition for me to break news. So he's awesome. And he's a great person who happens to be a monster on the court. And he's so much fun to watch. I love him. And I think he's, misconstrued in the media and that's meant a lot of that is his doing. It's the way he wants it. But I like that too. That's kind of funky cool about him. Other coaches. Doc Rivers has been great. Byron Scott's been great. Being in LA, I try to go to games and there and also in Phoenix and see people there. Jeff Hornacek here in Phoenix. I mean, everybody's been really, really friendly. Most of all, the thing that was the coolest for me was to spend a little time with the Spurs at training camp this year. And I've always respected that organization from a distance, always. If you don't, then I have no respect for you, because like what they've done is just unprecedented, and they've done it in such a classy way, I think. But to spend, you know, 45 minutes with Pop was phenomenal. And he was everything I thought that he would be, because I knew from, you know, people who know him well, PJ Carlesimo and people like that, that, you know, that's a facade. All the stuff during the end of quarter interviews, that's a facade. Is he difficult? Yeah. But is he really difficult when you get a minute to know him? Nope. He's wonderful and could not have been nicer and more respectful. And the things we talked about had nothing to do with basketball. It was just cool to have that confirmed live and in person. And he is all that and then some, as well as R.C. Buford. So I don't know. I feel like I've been fortunate to be given the opportunity to go. And I was on the road a lot, you know, basically, Richard, between the end of the finals and the beginning of the season, again in October, I'm off and it's awesome. but what I've learned in the past 2 years is that I'm really not as efficient or as good at anything when I have that much free time. So I chose to do several training camps this year and last year. And I even did some NFL Live. Like, I've been trying to do a lot of things to stay busy and stay in it. And I think when people see, especially coaches and players, that you're making a little bit of an extra effort, they respect you and realize that you're just not in this to go be some face on TV. You know, I mean, I love the sport and I love what goes into it. And so it's been neat to be able to get to know those people on a different level, and for them to have trusted me a little and to let me in is unique. And I would never, you know, I'd never abuse that. I think you have to be very careful with it. But most importantly, it's nice when they see that you're a human being, not some robot on TV, and not just there to ask questions or stir the pot. You know, we all have a job, and it's been cool, I think, on both sides, but for me to get to know them and some of the players. And I will say, like, this last finals, I mean, there was a moment, it was right before game 3, and we were in Cleveland, probably a couple minutes before tip-off, and I sat back, and Dwayne Wade was with us, I think that was that game. I sat back in my chair, and, you know, we're like really close to the floor. We're probably, I don't know, 12 rows up, but pretty close to the floor, and the energy in that building, you know, finals back in Cleveland, and LeBron, and the Warriors, and I kind of got choked up because I sat back in my chair and looked around, and it was deafening, and I couldn't hear a thing that the producers were saying, you know, stand by, 2 minutes out. I just took this deep breath, and I did. I got choked up because I thought, I cannot believe that this kid, you know, I was 12 years old when I said I wanted to do this, not this NBA, but be at the ESPN and be part of something big and meaningful that sports was just my passion, I don't think I'll ever take for granted the fact that I'm here and I'm living this dream. But I sat back and just soaked it up. And then I had to compose myself and not let my mascara run and go introduce our pregame show before game 3 of one of the best finals ever. The best team runs ever in the finals, and what a series that was, you know? So, I don't know. I'm sorry. I know you hate it when people get cheesy, but I just feel very fortunate to be in this position. And I promise I'll never take it for granted, because there's a million people out there who would die for this job. People who maybe have even worked harder. I don't know. Who've been through more. I've worked really, really hard, but why me? Why am I the one that this has happened to? I don't know. I try not to think about it too much, because I could think of a million reasons why maybe it shouldn't have been me, but it is. So I'm trying to enjoy all of those moments, because who knows when they'll be gone, you know? It could be tomorrow. Who knows?
Yeah, we certainly don't mind heartfelt thoughts on this podcast. And yeah, I mean, I really respect that you can appreciate and understand the fortunate position you're in. All right, Sage, you've given us a lot of time, so let's end.
One thing, Richard,
sure,
real quick, because I just want to make sure, like, I mean, thankful, because there have been so many people who've helped me along the way, and a lot of people at ESPN, people that usually get a lot of criticism. A lot of people have helped me quietly, and they wouldn't want anyone else to know. But sometimes it's a word here or there. Trust me, there's a lot of, I don't always feel supported. You don't always feel like people are on your team. But that's why when you do find those who are, and there's a lot of people there, that's why you hold them close and you cherish them, and then you try to give it back to people who are coming after you. Because I don't think that there's enough of that, of helping each other. And especially with women, a lot of ugliness there, and it's unnecessary. I think we can help each other out more. But I've learned so much in these last 20 years, for sure, but these last two, now that I'm in season three. And so no matter what, the good, the bad, the ups and downs, I wouldn't change a thing. And I'm really thankful for the opportunity. Even if people think I suck and my hair is too big and I talk too fast and, you know, whatever it is, like, they can have those opinions, but I know that I'm probably one of the luckiest people on the face of this earth, especially because I have the best of both worlds with work and with a family. Okay, I'll shut up. Go ahead.
All right, Sage, it's a podcast. You'd have to do the opposite of shutting up. and then, all right, so finally, we'll end with this. You've given us a lot of time, and we really appreciate it. Independent of whether it's an ESPN property, I like asking broadcasters this question in particular. There was one event that you would like to cover in your career. And again, it may not happen, and it does not have to be an ESPN property. What would that event be and why?
The Olympics. I've always wanted to cover the Olympics.
Right. Well, by the way, that's not coming to ESPN during your
right.
lifetime. So that might be a tough one.
Right. I know. I actually thought about that when I was signing this last deal. I'm like, man, because that I don't know if I'll ever get that opportunity, but that is part of where my love of sports began. And when actually the timing of it is 1984 and the Olympics in LA. And I remember we had just moved from overseas. We moved from Belgium to Colorado, and our furniture wasn't there yet. And I remember laying on the floor with my brothers and, you know, watching this like 12-inch screen and watching Carl Lewis and watching all the Olympians and Mary Lou Retton. And that's when I went, wow, this is what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a sportscaster because I knew I'd never get out of high school probably playing any sports competitively. So the second best way would be to cover it. And I, at 12 years old, was in awe of these athletes and how they worked their whole lives, and in particular the last 4 years, to lead up to this one moment, the 100-meter dash or the 200-meter butterfly or the all-around floor exercise in gymnastics or, you know, the equestrian stuff. I'm really into the equestrian stuff. This is that one moment that they've waited their whole lives for. How the heck do they not vomit all over themselves, like nervous for this one moment? Like, everything depends on this. And I mean, I was in awe of it then. And so to go to the Olympics and to cover it, to me, would be a dream come true. But like you said, as long as I'm at the worldwide leader, that ain't going to happen. So I'm just going to continue to be a great viewer and watch it. But I mean, that's why I am where I am today, is because of that love that was born from watching the 84 Olympics. I know a lot of people aren't high in the Olympics anymore, and especially certain sports with track and field and the doping. And but to me, it's so pure. And someday, I was saying to ESPN, I'm like, listen, I know we don't have, you know, the rights and all that, but, you know, especially with Team USA. And I mean, can I remember Jeremy Schapp a couple of years at one of the last Olympics, and, you know, he's up on some mountaintop at 3 a.m. and it's pitch right. black, and he's nowhere near any Olympic venues, but he's there. So I'm going to keep pushing. I'll do anything to go.
Yeah, keep pushing. First of all, that's a great Olympics, obviously, to fall in love with an 84 from Carl Lewis to Edwin Moses, Mary Lou Retton. And as someone who has covered 7 Olympics for Sports Illustrated, it is far and away the best assignment I've ever had. So
are you going to Rio?
I'm not going to Rio. It's the first one that I'm not going to in a long time because I am, like your husband, I will be on fatherhood.
I was just going to say, because you have those beautiful babies. Oh, yeah. By the way, Alan, how much has Richard changed since these babies were born?
Alan, do you want to go on? Alan has not really been an SI long enough to know that, but the answer is significantly.
Maybe a little bit.
You've softened, right?
I've gotten a little.
Air your dirty laundry here.
It's all right. But I will say this, you know, having seen Jeremy at multiple Olympics, you know, ESPN does send people, so you should keep pushing management, because there will be a couple people who have to go, especially for the Olympics where the U.S. is is going to do really well, like they will do in 2016. So I would not give up. I would not give up.
Well, say it again, and why don't you tweet it for me? Because they all read your tweets, right?
Next time I talk to John Skipper, we're having lunch tomorrow at Union Square Cafe. Right. All right. Listen, Sage Deal has been the guest. She is the current host of ESPN's NBA Countdown. She has worked at that network since, I believe, 2007. You've seen her on SportsCenter. I find her to be very interesting and honest, and she lived up to that on this podcast. Sage, you know, all bullshit aside, I really appreciate you doing this. I always enjoy talking to you, and I hope we can do it again. Thanks for being on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Listen, I know you have a lot of choices, so I appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
So how did your fantasy football team do this year? Are you still eligible for the playoffs? The great part about playing fantasy sports now is that you just don't play in one league. You play in a bunch of leagues. I will mention that this podcast has had many NFL guests, including Scott Hansen. Would be fun to be hanging out with Scott Hansen on a Sunday as you're watching your fantasy football league. Now, on FanDuel.com, when you use my code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, you can play a risk-free tournament in fantasy football, fantasy basketball, and fantasy hockey for up to $10. If you win, you keep the money. If you lose, FanDuel will refund your account guaranteed. Now, if you've had Russell Wilson the last couple weeks, you're probably doing very well in fantasy football. Fantasy owners who were smart enough to pick up Ted Ginn Jr. are wondering why the rest of us didn't see that. If you've picked up Ted Ginn Jr., God bless you. That is a nice fantasy football midseason pick. You think you know fantasy football? Come prove it at FanDuel. Building a team is easy and fun. Just pick your players and stay under the salary cap. Entry fees start at just $1, so there's a league for everyone. FanDuel offers the NFL, the NBA, the NHL, so you can play fantasy sports for real cash any night of the week. FanDuel is not just for large tournaments anymore. You can set up a private league and play against your friends anytime, anywhere. To get started, go to FanDuel.com, click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner, use the code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, and sign up now. Here is a great deal for new listeners. If you enter a league and you don't win, FanDuel will refund your money. That's any tournament you want, up to $10. You can sign up with FanDuel.com using my code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, then make a deposit and choose your league. If you don't win, you'll get that money right back in your FanDuel account for more play. The only way to get this no-lose offer is to go to FanDuel.com, click on the microphone, and use my code MEDIA. FanDuel.com, where I can finally pay to be a fan. That's FanDuel.com. Try it out today. If you want to win your fantasy league, the SI Fantasy Football Podcast has all the tips, all the rankings to get you ahead of the competition. Hear the SI Fantasy Football Podcast with Michael Beller, released twice a week on iTunes, Stitcher, and at SI.com/podcasts. All right, back in the studio, our thanks to Sage Steele for giving us a lot of time. I bring in Alan Kim. And Alan, I enjoyed Sage. People probably can tell from listening to the interview, I like her personally. I think she's interesting. I think she's honest. I have a lot of respect sort of for her, just her being forthright in terms of her background, her current relationship with her husband. I thought it was pretty interesting just in terms of her talking about just how even the sort of the story she told about being on The View and them sort of questioning her right to choose what race she is,
yeah,
which was pretty interesting. And actually, you know, I don't want you to leave this. I don't want you to edit this out of the podcast. Even during once in the podcast, I think I said I described her as African American, and she quickly reminded me she's biracial. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. It's sort of just the whole idea of perception and race and. And she's someone who's had to I don't know if I would say overcome, but you know, she didn't have anybody to sort of role model for her in this business the way somebody like Hannah Stormwood, the way somebody obviously like any 25-year-old white sportscaster right now growing up has a million people to emulate. So I found Sage interesting, and I know you as a Countdown and a basketball fan, you probably found the stuff about Simmons interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I just appreciated how candid she was. I thought it was pretty refreshing just hearing some of her takes. And to be honest, I didn't know she was biracial.
The The only thing I would say about the Simmons part is I think we both agree. She could have gone a lot further. I think she went about as far in answering the questions without giving specifics and without sort of getting her in a really bad jackpot. Like I said earlier, I know both Bill and Sage. I like them both personally. It's very clear to me, for lack of a better phrase, there was creative tension on that set. And to give Sage credit, and I guarantee, I imagine Bill feels the same way. You know, what happened in the past is in the past. They've both headed to, you know, greener pastures. Sage is on Countdown and well-respected in that company. Bill obviously is now at HBO and, you know, dominating in the podcast world. And so, you know, they're both obviously at an excellent place. But it'd be interesting one day to really get the answers to those questions from both of them on the record. I don't know if that will ever happen, but it would be interesting.
I don't think it'll happen either, but she sort of insinuated, like, kind of where it was at.
Yeah.
I kind of get it from her answers.
So. I think that's fair. All right, Alan, before we get out of here, I want you to know, I know you're a huge Hoops fan, but, you know, I've been watching a lot of Warriors games, and my premise is that the NBA at every turn should put the Warriors on national TV. I understand that there's a local deal with Comcast Bay Area, and obviously the NBA doesn't want its local carrier to, you know, sort of lose exclusivity and be screwed, but having watched these guys over the last couple of days, I watched the Celtics game and the game they lost to the Bucks. They're an amazingly fun team to watch.
Absolutely.
They're going to probably break the Bulls record. I think you may disagree with me. I think they're going to get close. And to me, if you have a once-in-a-generation season, you owe it to the fans to get those games on national TV, even if NBA TV picked them up. That would be good enough.
Can they flex schedule like in the NFL?
The league can put on any game it wants on NBA TV.
That's true, but not everyone has NBA TV.
Correct, and the larger question with ESPN, obviously, is there are limits to the amount of times one team can be on. Each ESPN and TNT can ask for certain things. They can ask to flex, but, and I totally respect this, if you're a national carrier like them, you do got to weigh, you don't want to just overweight, I guess, your network with just one team, because you know there are other great teams in the league, and you don't want viewers to just, you know, think that you're the official carrier of the Warriors. That said, I think when there's like a uniquely special team, I think you got to try to put them on as much as possible. And I hope if they're like 69-4, I hope we see like 10 of those remaining, whatever, 11 games or something.
They have to. Like, how could you not?
I hope so. So the NBA is fun, and, you know, the open court podcast, guys.
Open floor.
Open floor. I'm sorry. Apologize to Chris Mannix and Matt Dollinger and Alan Kim and Dan Bloom. You guys are going to have a lot to talk about in terms of that podcast. All right, listen, let's wrap up. For Sage Steele, we appreciate her giving us time. For producer Alan Kim, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you next time on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.